What can be said about the possibility of a final conflict taking place between the forces of good and evil? Hello, welcome to Good Word. I am David Thomas, your host for this conversation. I am with Paul Dibdahl and Brant Berglund, two fine teachers in the Walla Walla University School of Theology. And gentlemen, we are looking this week at a lesson entitled The Impending Conflict. And to those who believe in the great controversy between good and evil, there comes a point where the controversy ramps up to an end. What can we say about that and what the Bible teaches about that?
It's not surprising. In fact, I'm a little bit surprised by the title of this lesson, The Impending Conflict, because there's been conflict all along. So, I mean, I understand what they're getting at here, but from the start, the fall of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, all through the pages of Scripture, we see this conflict raging, I think, between good and evil. And so if there's going to be a heaven, an eternity of bliss and delight and peace and harmony and restoration, then the conflict has to end at some point. And that's the picture we get in Scripture, that there will be an end.
A final showdown.
Yeah.
And if I can be so bold as to point to the secular world, everybody longs for it. How many movies and books end with the final battle between good and evil? You know, secular movies that you would never want to watch, and yet the ending is good triumphing and evil coming to an end, right? It's like, why is that so written on the human heart and mind? Why do our societies need that kind of a story? Isn't it the introduction to the Great Controversy book where it says that we don't need to be told there is a controversy? We know it.
We experience it.
We experience it day to day. We admit that it's there. Yeah. What we need is to know what's happening in that conflict and how it will end and what's the outcome.
That ending of the conflict represents a transition into a time of peace, which I think everybody longs mm-hmm. for.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet the book of Revelation does talk about things ramping up towards the end, that there's a culmination of events that happens in our world where people ally themselves with one side or another. People, Paul, you had mentioned earlier the word Babylon. I love that phrase, those arrayed against God. It's not a literal city, but at some point, there has to be a fall of Babylon, and the climactic events have to take place.
And so you would agree that ultimate loyalty is, or worship, as I would call it, because, you know, worship means to ascribe worth to something. Mm-hmm. And so worship really is asking the question, where do you attach or where do you focus your ultimate loyalty? That plays a role in this conflict.
It's not only vital to know, but it is, I think at some point Revelation suggests there will be issues. Chapter 13, there's a beast that arises that forces the issue of worship. It makes it an issue of worship, just like it was for Daniel's friends in Babylon. It establishes an image, and it says everybody has to worship this or on pain of death. Now, again, at what level? We're talking about symbolism. People can have those debates, but there's no question that allegiance and ultimately worship God, give him glory, for the hour of his judgment has come. That stands in contrast to worship the beast, worship the image in Revelation. Now, has that time come? You know, we've talked about nuances throughout our study so far. I don't think that time has come in the Revelation mold, but I think everybody has had moments where they've had to make choices that are going to lead up to a final sort of impending conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, of course, the big question is, who are the players going to be?
Mm.
Hmm. Good and evil, Dave.
Good and evil.
Revelation symbolism suggests that those we maybe have put the most trust in may be on the side of not working in our favor ultimately. In Revelation, it uses this idea of the metaphor of a woman, a beautiful woman. The Old Testament represents the people of God. In the book of Revelation, she has turned from her allegiance. She's become, like the Old Testament Israel, she's become a prostitute. She's allied herself with nations and philosophies and worship that looks like it's idolatry, but it's spiritual adultery. And in the end, she leads a coalition against the people of God. That means that those that we have thought were on our side as Christians, and I have to be careful because that means that I have the danger of being in that same role, right? I have to watch out that I don't take the place of becoming Paul, when we had talked about persecution, mm-hmm. could I be the persecutor, mm-hmm. right? Could I be? And Revelation calls me to ask and to watch out.
I have not been a great fan of the book of Revelation. Sorry to tell you that.
I'm sorry, Dave. No.
But I'm with Dave also. And I think it's a level of intimidation maybe for me. And
well, it might be. But to me, there is something I do like about the book a great deal. And that is that the big picture is very clear in the book of Revelation.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And so I gave up some years ago trying to figure out all the arguments of who the specific elements of a coalition will be, because it's the big picture that fascinates me, is that we start with trouble on this earth, but there are believers who are, through all the beasts and machinations in Revelation, end up in a new heaven and a new earth.
And they are faithful in spite of the challenges, right? Yeah. They're faithful. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
My own approach to this has been an interesting one, because I've asked myself the question, the beast that you talk about there, how does this beast behave? It behaves in a very coercive, intolerant manner, trying to force its opinions on people or you die.
Right.
And so I've taken that kind of as a metaphor. So, okay, so who's acting in a beastly way?
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
Who's acting in a beastly way? And I wonder, and I think Adventists have looked at this too. Of course, like most Protestants, the Roman Catholic Church has figured in this equation in people's minds for many years. But we also talked about apostate Protestantism, and I've also heard talks about spiritualism, and I've heard talks about communism, and I've heard talks about
Islam.
Fundamentalist Islam. And so all these opinions clash, and they argue. Everybody argues for their particular favorite entity, but I'm interested in those debates and I listen to them, but I don't really engage in them, because it appears to me that the final coalition is not fully defined. It may involve people who surprise us, as you say,
and it appears that it's going to be a bigger coalition maybe than we expect.
And the
one of the key markers is that it is a woman. And the woman in Scripture, if it's related to the people of God, but it's also the kings of the earth. And what we end up with is religious ideology using state power for its ends.
Yeah, yeah.
That is exactly what happened during the time of the apostate Christian church for over 1,000 years, when the church-state power of Rome was in charge, right? They used coercion. The church took state power. That is a dangerous thing, whether it's Sharia law and Islam, that'll be dangerous. It will persecute. Whether it's an idea, a leftist ideology in secular communism, or even in some branches of American politics today, ultimately, if it uses state power, it will persecute. And I think that's a warning to the religious among us. Activism using the state will almost always backfire.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that evangelicalism in America has lost a lot of ground, because in the days of Jerry Falwell and company, and who are the presidents there, the Bushes.
The religious right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It made a bid for political power.
Right.
But see, you cannot enforce religious beliefs. And this is what amazes me, because of that old saying that he who is persuaded against their will is of the
same opinion still.
Yeah. And you cannot enforce the deepest loyalties of a person. There are things that you grant to somebody. I choose to be ultimately loyal to this. And we talked about the martyrs in an earlier day, that these are choices that they made that link their ultimate loyalties to this or to that. And so this idea of trying to enforce belief is a spectacular failure in human history. I mean,
it's
resulted in the death of millions.
Yes, it has. It has. And isn't this why the seal of God and the mark of the beast are juxtaposed in Revelation? Those who follow – you want the macro picture, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Those who follow God receive the seal only in their foreheads. It is because it's only through my belief and my mental assent and my trust and having the law of God written on my forehead, his law, his name, his character written, that I can follow him. But the beast, he can coerce worship. I don't have to believe anything he says, but I'll go along with it just to get him off my back, right?
Yeah, you just
I can receive a mark in my hand by what I do, or I can believe in what he does and get a mark in my forehead. The seal of God isn't that way, because God never coerces. My action will always follow my belief in my heart, right, if God has written his law there. Yeah. So the big picture, we see the mark of the beast being different from the seal as evidence of coercion from the start. But the good news is that the conflict, while, again, going back to Matthew 24, while it's like birth pangs upon a pregnant woman that increase and get harder, there is some good news to it, that the conflict, if there was ever a time – didn't we start our quarter talking about persecution and growing mm-hmm, character? Mm-hmm. If there's ever a time for God's people to develop character, here's an opportunity, right? Yeah. There's a conflict that we'll get to go through that will test our mettle. And I look forward to that, I guess.
Another way I've looked at this is by trying to keep tabs on issues of freedom of conscience and religious liberty. And this is where I think the U.S. is very interesting to me, because we are the country, above all others, that enshrined this freedom of choice and religious freedom in our Constitution. Other people have it there, but they don't really do much with it. But what happens when a country like ours, which has been the vanguard of this, begins to erode those beliefs? You begin to see how the whole world, which was once fascinated with our decision to allow that, is now drifting away. In fact, I read today about England, where now a street preacher has been arrested for preaching Christianity on the streets.
Yep.
And so religious intolerance in a progressive society, religious intolerance which wants to hold to specific beliefs, becomes unacceptable. Mm. It becomes a crime.
Well, we saw to some degree the level the state will go even during COVID, right, to say, well, you may have the right to worship, but we can curtail that right if it's for the public good.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the laws or the mandates during COVID were all bad laws or mandates, but it is interesting how it ceased to be a right when the government said it, we don't want it to be. Now can no longer worship together, and maybe, it's for our good, but still, it's
interesting,
not a right.
Institutions were not required to close.
Yeah, yeah.
See, but I suppose when you get together with people, and as churches do, that you're all in close proximity, and that's a worry. But anyway, well, that's very interesting. I guess so. There's coming a time of great conflict, and there's a lot of conversation about who the chief players will be. But we're kind of landing on the question of it's probably going to be bigger than what most people think, and some of the elements may surprise us. But the key element is worship, whether it's done voluntarily or whether it's conscripted. Mm-hmm. And so I guess we'll leave that there for now and let people work their own way. I'm very comforted by the big picture myself. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Paul and Brandt, for that. Appreciate it, and we'll be moving on to the closing rounds of this discussion in the weeks to come. So my thanks to Kristen Byerly, our engineer, and my thanks to you for listening in. For The Good Word, I'm David Thomas.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.